Today on Pilot's Discretion, our guest is retired airline pilot and author Kevin Garrison. He tells us about growing up as an airport kid, how to keep flying fun, and what makes for a good airport dog. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, everyone. I'm John Zimmerman, and thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion from Sporties. You can catch up on previous episodes and find today's show links at sporties.com/podcast, and you can send us an email with your comments or guest ideas at podcast@sporties.com. Today, I'm excited to welcome Kevin Garrison to the show, a name that many listeners will know from his long career as a writer for AvWeb, IFR Magazine, Cessna Flyer, and many, many others. He spent over 30 years as an airline pilot, flying almost every model Boeing made, and today he flies a Cessna 140. He also has a new book out called The High in the Righty, which is filled with Kevin's unique mix of humor and practical advice. Kevin, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
You grew up as an airport kid, and you wrote this in your book early on. Quote, the people in Kevin's airport home were not his parents or siblings, but they raised him to adulthood in the world of flying and aviation.
Wow.
That's a great description of how many people, I think, come up in aviation. And I wonder, do you think airport kids still exist today?
I'm not completely sure because I don't see many of them. Not in the same way we did it in the good old days, you know, but I'm sure they're out there. It may just be a different way of doing things now. They're not allowed across the concertina wire to go sit in airplanes like I did. And my circumstance was, I think, special because I grew up in Lakeland, Florida, and I was at Lakeland Airport, you know, prior to Sun and Fun, actually, where you could just walk on the property and sit in airplanes till somebody chased you away.
Yeah, I often rage about how we've made country GA airports with no airline traffic of any kind into what they look like prisons. And I don't think that's good for making airports look like welcoming parts of the community. But if I'm a pilot at my local GA airport and I see one of these airport kids, maybe on the other side of the fence, what's a good thing for me to do to maybe encourage in the right way a kid to feel welcome at the airport and encourage them about aviation?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's more difficult, I think, in our situation today. You can't just drive up in your van and invite a kid to get in to go to the airport. There have been times at my airport, my little 140 is based in Georgetown, Kentucky, and there are times when kids are there. They're generally kids of other pilots. I don't think I've actually seen a for real Horatio Alger story kid like I always portray myself as, you know, biking out to the airport. And I just don't see that. And I'm not sure if it'll come back because this is just my opinion and I'm old, but kids nowadays seem to have a program that's monitored in order for them to have activities where I and me and maybe even you're old enough, we were just turned loose on society and had to be home by dinner and we weren't tracked and I could spend a whole day at the airport and nobody knew I was there, you know?
Yeah, that's a podcast for another day, but I have a whole speech on that. And as a parent of teenagers can tell you, the overscheduling and cutthroat youth sports and all of that culture is certainly not good for encouraging kids to spend a lazy afternoon at the airport.
Yeah.
We will leave that ticking time bomb behind before it consumes us because I wanted to then move to the next phase in your aviation career. After growing up as that airport kid, you did what I would call a fairly typical route of building time, gaining experience. You flew checks at night, towed banners, some of those classic time building activities that people did 70s, 80s, even into the 90s. A lot of those don't really exist anymore. You know, people aren't flying checks around and beat up old 210s anymore. So what did you learn during those jobs that you can't learn as a flight instructor, say, these days? Are there skills and experiences that you gain in those kind of forgotten jobs that were valuable to you later in your career?
Yes, and I'm not sure how that could be duplicated today either. A lot of what I learned, for example, flying checks, I forget if it was 4 or 5 nights a week, I was frightened a lot because I was by myself. If you're flying a light twin through the southeast during thunderstorm season at night and you haven't slept in 3 days, you kind of learn your limits. And now I've learned just through my exposure to local university here that has a flying program, these young people aren't exposed to that. And that's probably a good thing. They're pretty much looked after all the way through their college career, and then they're never out from under supervision on their own to go scare themselves, to learn, hey, you know, everybody else may be going through this line of thunderstorms, but I'm not going to do it, which happened more than once during my airline career. And I don't know how you can simulate being frightened or even if that's a good thing. But yeah, you see things. I think that may be the advantage, honestly. If you have 3,000 hours when an airline hires you, you've seen a lot of stuff, especially if you're operating at the lower level of the food chain without weather radar, without autopilots, and all that kind of stuff. To make my answer even longer, I've had this discussion with the college kids that I taught last fall. There are other avenues, I think, now to fly. You just have to look for them, and you have to be willing to do them either for free or to almost free. And, you know, I give this example. When my airline hired me, they started us at $400 a month, and that was a pay raise for me. And I was really excited because it was steady money. Anyway.
So that's a perfect segue into, I wanted to ask you about your airline career and some of the lessons learned there. I'm always interested in the lessons GA pilots can learn from the pros. And I love, in one of your books, you wrote that your first rule as a captain was, whoever is the most scared wins. Now, it sounds like that comes from a place of experience from some early flying days. So what do you mean by that rule? What's the point of that?
Well, I can't take credit for that. I've had more than one captain teach me that. Well, especially if you're in a crew, I found that even with an inexperienced co-pilot, and believe me, most of my co-pilots were more experienced, better backgrounds than me. I'm not putting them down as lesser pilots. But it was my responsibility as a captain to make the final decision things. And I found that if I was locked in, for example, if it was my leg and I was flying, and I was locked in, like when I was flying the old DC-9, to go, again, thunderstorms is the example, going through a line of thunderstorms and trying to work my way through it, I'd get so locked in. I think it's called hyper-focusing. I think that's what we CFIs call it. I don't know. And my co-pilot would punch me in the shoulder and go, hey, dummy, we don't have to go through here. If we go 30 miles west, we can miss the whole line. Or if you're approaching and you're ready to do battle with this group of whatever, and the co-pilot goes, oh, boy, I don't know if I like this. Well, it's time to slow down and go, yeah, okay, well, let's, you know. The thing is, airline passengers especially don't remember if you get them there safely and comfortably. If you scare the crap out of them, they're never going to forget, and they're never going to stop talking to their friends about it. So in terms of marketing alone, that's a good idea. Also, nowadays, in the old days, captains didn't elicit advice from lower crew members. And it's a CRM thing. It's a human factors thing. But they got to feel comfortable being uncomfortable and telling you they are. And then occasionally you'll have a low-time co-pilot or maybe an F-18 driver who's never flown light twins in the Southeast, and you're flying an MD-88. And you can go, look, yeah, I know you're concerned, but I've done this a million times. It's going to work out. See, you know, we're going to do A, B, and C. And, you know, I can't shoot down Russians, and they can. It's just different backgrounds.
So that brings up the CRM topic. You mentioned it. And I think CRM is one of the great advances in safety. I mean, the airline safety record seems to show that it's effective, but it can go too far. As you wrote at one point, I have nothing against CRM as a concept. I have a lot of trouble when it becomes a religion. So how do you find that balance there between welcoming input, making the cockpit a safe place to express your concerns, but also not being so trapped in debate that you never go anywhere? How do you handle that as a crew member up there?
Well, realistically, I don't think CRM, I think there's a difference between, I'm waving my arm anyway, I think there's a difference between CRM in the classroom and the amount of time airlines and air carriers spend on CRM and actual human factors in the cockpit. For example, when we started CRM in the early days, I even taught it for a while, we brought in a bunch of psychologists and they came up with new terms like heuristics, and we had We had pretend camel lots where we sold used camels. I mean, it's just, and we spent days and days. And it was a good thing. And that was one thing. The other thing, though, is when you're flying a trip, we pretty much always got along. But if you flew with somebody who was kind of a jerk, well, then the CRM kind of came in handy because the company had an expectation that we were going to do that. Where prior to that, they had no expectation that we would do that. It was all on the captain. And it was quite a few trips I was on, especially in the 727, when I was an engineer, where I was told not to bother to read any of the checklists. They'd let me know if they wanted one, you know, things like that. And then later, when the company accepted the human factors thing, it really, and I'm considered, I think, maybe a more of a humorous pilot, but it was really nice to have that expectation that all the checklists were going to be done in order. And everybody did everything the same way. We didn't pass secret notes. Nobody had secret procedures. Nobody was doing flap-up landings just to prove they could, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, this really gets to one of the old jokes about pilots and, you know, how do you know if there's a pilot in the room? Don't worry, they'll tell you. Well, so one of my favorite quotes from PJ O'Rourke, a writer I know you admire as well, is that hubris is one of the great renewable resources. And I think about that often in the context of pilots, especially if you're at a hangar flying session and the stories are really spinning out of control. How do you manage that, especially in an airline world where you're flying with different pilots every week? There's not some long-term relationship that you've been flying with the same pilot in the right seat for 10 years. So how do you, is it the checklists and the culture and the SOPs? How do you keep the ego out of it when you're making decisions?
Well, again, in a flight crew, this is going to sound off-putting to non-flyers, but in a flight crew, we're first name basis. We make fun of each other. If a guy can't make fun of himself, he's probably not going to be around much. When I was a captain, it's different when you're a co-pilot or an engineer, a flight engineer. You're kind of a junior officer. You know, you buy the cigarettes, you arrange the dinners. It's a junior officer role. When you're the captain, I would always try to talk a little bit to whoever it was when we would get in the cockpit. We didn't do a lot of formal briefing stuff, except as required by the checklist, you know, departure briefing, that kind of stuff. And I would normally fly the first leg just so they could lower their expectations and just relax and, you know, and see that I was kind of not a jerk. And we would just get along from there. If we had difficulties, this is also going to be off-putting to the public. If we had personality conflicts, we would generally recognize that. And after the first day, we'd meet in the bar or in a restaurant and talk it out. And that usually, I never really had a lot of conflicts with people. My co-pilots may disagree, but it was like flying with your computer dates because the airline kind of hired the same kind of people, maybe not with the same backgrounds, but we all had the same attitudes. And one more thing I'll add, in a three-person cockpit as opposed to a two-person cockpit, that was much better because if you're flying with a jerk, there was always another person you could talk to.
Interesting point.
Yeah.
So what's an airline habit you've adapted to your GA flying? Something you learned at the airlines that's just as useful at 100 knots and 1,000 feet?
Well, habit patterns are really important. We would, in the airline world, they're usually called flows. When I taught on the MD-88, and my last airline job was a pilot examiner, you follow the checklist, but you know the flows. I have a Cutlass RG, that's redundant. I have a Cessna 172 RG that I own part of. And of course, I follow the checklist, but I have a flow. I have a habit pattern. Every takeoff, every landing, I do the same thing, same way. Every time in the airline world, I'd get in my seat the same way. I'd hook up my headset the same way. My oxygen mask would be tested the same way. And of course, when you're flying 80 hours a month, that's really easy to have habit patterns that establish that. And then the other thing I would add was in the airline world, particularly, I learned this, and I think everybody else in the airline world knows this. You're always going to make mistakes. Every single leg, you're going to make a mistake or two. And that's why there's two people there. And previously three people. And Aeroflot had five people. You're always catching each other. Like, hey, did you want to do this? If I'm a co-pilot and the guy's about ready to shoot the approach, and we've got a few minutes, and I notice we haven't done the approach checklist, you just say, hey, Jim or Joe. Most captains are Bob. You go, hey, Bob, you know, you want to run the approach check? And he'd go, oh, yeah, I guess we need to do that, you know. Or one time in my career, I was landing in Dallas, and my co-pilot said, hey, do you want to land on the runway they cleared us on instead of the one you're clearly aiming toward? And I'd go, well, yeah, sure. If you do it a lot, you got to not be loosey-goosey about it, but you got to relax. I flew with guys so wound up, so tense when things were normal, you wondered what in the world they were going to do if something went wrong. If they're that tense when we're just flying on a clear day, you know, you go, holy crap, I hope we don't catch on fire or something, you know, but anyway.
So right now there's a whole new generation of pilots joining the ranks as professionals in airlines, really a generational turnover in the airline pilot world. What is the best advice you could give to them as they start out, from a grizzled veteran to the new guy sitting in the right seat? What do you wish you could tell them?
Oh, the lessons I learned. Okay. First of all, you belong there. Whenever you get hired by an airline, you go through, I forget the name of the term, but it's where you think you're probably some kind of, you're getting away with something. Though they know who you are, you belong there. Also, you're not competing with anybody anymore. You're on a seniority list. As long as you're a competent, good pilot, that's fine. You don't have to be a better pilot than the captain to get ahead. The seniority list is going to get you ahead, so you can relax a little bit, which I think actually makes you a better pilot. You're not competing with people. When people senior to you succeed, you're happy for them because you're going to be there someday. The other thing is, there's a zillion things. The other thing I would say is you have to realize that no matter how much the airline tells you you're a member of a family, you're not. You're an employee of the company. So you can, the member of the family mythology is great, and it works for the airline, and it's actually nice for the employee. But at the bottom line, when it comes retirement time or when it comes time for them to cancel your pension or something, you're really an employee. So don't waste a lot of time worrying about being a family member. Just be a good employee and see if I can think of anything else. That sounds kind of bitter, but it's really not. Oh, the other thing is, and I've addressed this before, and I may be totally wrong. Big hiring boom going on now, right? Oh, we can't get enough pilots. Well, I've noticed, I think FedEx and UPS are already having shortage. They're already telling, maybe it was United too recently. They want people to voluntarily not get paid anymore, which I don't know, guys. I think I'd wait till they furloughed me so I got some furlough rights. But anyway, it's a cyclical business. There's going to be huge hiring booms followed by huge droughts and layoffs and all that. And you just got to ride with it. I was a flight engineer 5 separate times where I got canceled back. And in the long run, it all worked out, and it makes you grind your teeth when it happens. But it's the advantage is it's a slow process. And I'm going to sound leftist here, so watch out. Being in a pilot union, I think, is generally a good thing because it lets somebody else handle all the unpleasantness with the company. It's a layer between you and the company and unpleasantness when it happens. Anyway, that's it.
Some great advice there. I love the part about not worrying about competition. So many pilots are so competitive trying to get that interview, and it really does take a shift of mindset when you get there. Kevin, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, I want to talk about having fun when we fly.
Okay.
Earn all your pilot ratings and keep your flying skills sharp with Sporty's Pilot Training Plus. This all-inclusive membership unlocks Sporty's complete library of award-winning video courses so you can learn anywhere you have your phone, tablet, or laptop. For one annual fee, you get access to over $1,500 in courses, a smart investment in your flying career. Plus, enjoy free shipping every day of the year at sporties.com and apply for one of our 3 annual flight training scholarships. Learn more at sporties.com/pilot training. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We are back with Kevin Garrison, who these days can be found flying his Cessna 140 around Kentucky, which sounds like a lot of fun. And that's something that I think is underrated, Kevin. You write in your book, some pilots get so caught up in the seriousness of flying that they forget that having fun is why they started. And, I'm not going to suggest people be rash and do stupid things and buzz their girlfriend's house and all that. That doesn't have to mean fun. But I do think you're right that sometimes we forget why we do it. So how do you maintain that fun part? How do you have fun when you fly while still being safe and making good decisions?
Well, I think it has to do with maybe ego. And, you know, I'm going to flaunt my ego here. I've flown a lot of stuff from the 777 to the, you know, Cubs and, you know, blah, blah, blah. It'll all be in the movie about me later. But the thing is, if a Cessna 150 paid as much money as the Boeing 777 did, I would have been just as happy flying a Cessna 150. So everybody just needs to kind of get over themselves, especially in today's world of wall-to-wall avionics. And I'm guilty of that. My Cessna 140 has, you know, electronic ADIs and, you know, ForeFlight and all that. So to have fun, I just go out. I like going out just spending time out there. I have a little lounge chair in my hangar and, you know, friends, and we don't do crazy stuff. We might go get lunch, or we might, you know, fly some, we're working on a Stearman now. We'll end up flying that later this month. And just try to, and this is hard nowadays with all the different types of, you know, ADS-B and all this stuff. It, just go have fun. Just, you know, if you want to circle a cow for an hour, you know, do that. I don't recommend buzzing cows. I used to buzz cows in an air coupe that I had, and I lost like four pairs of sunglasses. But they were cheap sunglasses. It was the 70s. So I don't know, except I have noticed in the EAA crowd, they seem to have a good time. I go to the local EAA meetings. We have a good time. But generally, the concept of fun in aviation seems to be dwindling. I don't know if that's your observation. But at the local airport where it used to be, maybe five or six people would be in the pattern and five or six people be drinking Diet Cokes in front of their hangar, it's generally nowadays just me, you know?
Yeah, I think there's two things you raised there that are great points. One is the community aspect. And one reason, the most fun I have is when I'm with other people, other pilots, some people flying. I think that's why a lot of the EA people, as you said, have fun. There's chapter, there's a personal connection. So I do think that personal connection is really, really important. But the other point about sometimes you have to make yourself take a flight with no plan and literally take off and we're going to fly east with no destination and circle the first thing that's interesting. I think sometimes, I know I do this, you get so locked in your mission mindset and, you know, I'm chasing some hour goal for a job or I've got some trip I need to complete or whatever it might be. And every once in a while, you almost need to schedule a flight that has absolutely no goal whatsoever other than to follow where your interest goes. The interest, because there's always something new if you're just willing to look for it.
That's very good advice. And the general attitude, I'm not mad about this, but you'll find most aviation publications, they're very good about selling product, which I know that's your business and that's a good thing. But on the other hand, they also seem to always have a big section about the latest accidents. Hmm. And that's good for safety, I suppose, but you'll never see a boating magazine with an entire section dedicated to fatal boat accidents. So, I mean, I know it's a serious subject, but you can have fun without dwelling and be safe, not dwelling on all the doom and gloom.
How did you keep from getting bored as an airline pilot? I mean, it's a job at the end of the day. You've flown some of those routes dozens, hundreds of times. How do you keep a spark of joy in that job? Or is it impossible after a while?
Well, I do have to admit that by the end of my career, I'd be at home on a day off and I'd be going, damn it, I have to fly to Paris tomorrow again. You know, so you get jaded. On the other hand, I really enjoyed flying with the other people. I'll say the guys, generically, they were mostly male. I just had fun with these guys and I missed them desperately when I left because who was I going to go have a beer with or go have dinner with? And my son later reminded me that in our town right here, we have beer and dinners. So I could do it with other people. But there's a certain, this is also egotistical sounding, but when you're an airline pilot having fun and talking with other airline pilots or at any level of piloting, it's a different language. You understand things with a nod and a grin that other people just don't get. But for often the job was clearly a job. 3 a.m. in any airplane in bad weather is not fun. If it's a 777 or a 150, that's why they pay you money. Well, that and not killing people.
All right, I'm going to put you on the spot here. You had an article recently about radio communications that I agreed with completely, but I'm guessing many people did not. So let's say I'm out flying a tail dragger for fun. I'm doing one of these flights. It's a beautiful Sunday afternoon. I'm just cruising around. And I decide not to make a radio call for every last leg of the pattern at my non-towered airport. Explain to me why that is actually okay.
Well, everybody can relax. I actually looked this up for the article because I thought, well, maybe I'm missing something. But all the radio calls in non-controlled airspace, you know, your local non-towered airport, are recommended. They're not required. And then I looked up some company, and I'm not sure if it was yours or not, but the syllabus called for that. You know, I'm upwind, I'm downwind, my left elbow itches, now I'm doing this, now I'm doing that. And none of it's required. My advice to people is, if you are flying and you have a radio, you're not required to have one. If you don't have the radio, do the procedures, enter the pattern at the right place, keep your eyes open. If you do have a radio, make the calls that you think are pertinent to letting people know where you are. Generally, when I go in, even if there are three or four people in the pattern, I will call entering the downwind. If they don't know about bases and finals and upwinds and crosswinds, they shouldn't be in the air. And we've got ADS-B now, so we're generally finding each other on the fish finder anyway. I would also say this, that I've seen people in my long, never-to-be-repeated career as a flight instructor, along with being an airline pilot, people get so hung up on making radio calls that they don't actually fly their airplane safely. There's really no need to communicate every thought you've ever had to anybody on the radio. If you're flying the airplane and you see the guy in front of you in the pattern, you don't have to tell him that you're behind him. He doesn't care. You're behind him. And finally, I'll end with this. Maybe I'm a little guilty of going the other way towards non-communication, because as an airline pilot, after all those years when I retired, I was so sick and tired of talking on the daggum radio all the time, to the company, to center, to this, to that, on the intercom with the flight attendants, making PAs, that not talking on the radio to me is lovely. I can just hop in my plane and go. Clothing optional. Just go fly, you know. And we even would make fun, as airline guys, we would make fun, because you'll be en route and you'll find people asking, for example, an airline I won't mention, but their initials are American, would constantly ask for ride reports and give ride reports on totally clear and smooth days. Hi, this is blah, 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 123 at 350. It's smooth. Well, if it's smooth, nobody cares. Don't tell them. And then I had one guy that I flew with, and I'll cut this off because I know we're probably short on time, but I knew that this guy I flew with on my airline, when I flew co-pilot for him, he hated ride reports. He would just not give them. I don't care if the airplane was coming apart. I was not allowed to give ride reports when I flew for the guy. So one time when I was flying the 777, he was in an MD-11 right in front of me in his airplane going to Europe, and I was right behind him, and he'd get on and off frequencies ahead of me, and then every time I'd get on the frequency, I'd ask center to ask the guy in front of me how the rides were.
That's fantastic.
Anyway, yeah, I don't know. If people want to talk on your radio, great. Maybe it's because students are nervous about radio calls and instructors want to encourage them to make a lot, but I really don't give a wet slap if you're taxing to the fuel pumps. And the other thing I'll say before I close, it's bound to give us lots of hate mail. When you leave the area, please don't say last call. I don't care if it's your last call. I'm not keeping a log. Nobody's, you know, just leave. Your lack of being there will tell me you're not there.
That's a recent innovation that I don't care for either. Kevin, we always like to end Pilot's Discretion with a lightning round we call Ready to Copy. I'll ask some questions on a wide range of topics, and you give me your quick answer. Are you ready to copy?
Okay. Yeah.
You mentioned you're a flight instructor for a while. You've done lots of that. What is one lesson you wish every student pilot could learn?
Tie down the airplane when you get done with it. Take care of the airplane.
Should flight instructors ever wear epaulets?
No. No, a shirt would be nice, but epaulets are not required.
What is a myth about being an airline pilot that you would like to bust?
That we're all super serious people with 30-pound wristwatches.
You sure about the wristwatch part? You flew almost every Boeing model. Which one was your favorite?
The 727. I got to fly all three seats, and I kind of grew up on it. And it's the only airplane I remembered because I was a new hire when I went to school on it, and I had to study that one.
Boeing has made a lot of headlines recently with their troubles. Do you think this story is overrated or underrated in terms of how serious the situation is?
I think things are going about normally. There'll be a lot of media attention, and I do think they have problems. But I don't know if people remember Chrysler in the old days. Every company has problems at some point. My airline had problems. We were on TV a lot for a few years. So I hope things work out, but I'm certainly no expert on airplane manufacturing.
Which is the better airplane, Cessna 140 or Champ?
Champ.
And why is that?
I just love a Champ. I own a 140, but I love a Champ. Well, it's a kid thing. When I was a line boy in Lakeland, we had a Champ that a church owned, and I think the guy was trying to save my soul, and he let me fly it. And you could fly it without shoes, without a shirt, without a door, you know, put auto gas in it. We just had so much fun with that thing. And that'll never happen again because I was young and, you know, the world was new. But in my mind, that's more fun.
Yeah, I have a little bit of time in a Citabria that you can take the door off and sort of, you know, close to a Champ related. And boy, a Citabria or a Champ with the door off at 500 feet over the river at sunset is pretty good. I don't get too poetic, but that's pretty good flying.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
What makes for a good airport dog?
Well, an ability to stand lots of noise. My dog, Hank, I have a Border Collie Basset Hound mix, and he does not like the airport because it's noisy. So I guess you need a deaf dog. And there is a dog in Cynthiana that I like. I'm sorry, I can't remember his name now, but he's just kind of there all the time. Usually, I think maybe an older dog that can just lay around under your seat might be the best airport dog.
How about a good airport bum?
I don't think they exist anymore, except for me.
Well, if I'm an aspiring one, what's your advice if I want to start the next generation of airport bums? What do I need to know?
Well, when you're walking on the flight line looking in airplane windows, I usually try to keep my hands behind my back, like I'm not going to touch anything. Be courteous when they come out to challenge you, although I guess I'm old and they think I'm harmless. I don't get challenged a lot. And yeah, buy lunch occasionally for everybody. That seems to help. I don't know. I don't know if it's a welcoming place for bums anymore, like me. I find myself alone out there a lot.
You live on a horse farm in Kentucky, so give us a tip for handling a horse better. Maybe I'm going out on a trail ride on vacation, something like that. What's something I should remember if I'm not a natural horse person?
Horses are wonderful people, creatures. Horses are not people. And they're fun, and you get to know them, and you know their personalities. But always keep in mind, they weigh 2,000 pounds, and they can go nuts on you in a second. So anything that weighs that much, you need to respect them kind of like a propeller is always hot. And, I mean, even my old 35-year-old carriage horse, I kind of give, you know, just remember, he's a big animal, and he's not a toy, and he's not your buddy.
Our last question is always the same on this podcast. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Oh my goodness. I hadn't thought of that. Maybe I should. I'm getting pretty old, but I think I'd like to fly the Champ out of Lakeland one more time, the way it was in the early 70s, you know, when you could land on the grass or land on the ramp, you know, not get above 200 feet. And yeah. Because then the whole world would be in front of you, you know, even if it really wasn't.
Kevin, thanks for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.